The Environmental Protection Agency has proposed tightening the standard for smog. The goal is cleaner air and improved human health. But due to a quirk in atmospheric chemistry, the move would likely increase global warming. NPR's Richard Harris explains.
Smog isn't just ugly. EPA official Lydia Wegman says ozone smog kills, so setting a new lower limit for ground-level ozone is a good thing.
There are very significant human health benefits that can be achieved.
Less smog means fewer asthma attacks, fewer kids in the hospital, and fewer days of lost school.
And we also believe that we can reduce the risk of early death for people with heart and lung disease.
But it turns out that fixing this problem is likely to make another one worse. That would be global warming. That's because the way many states and localities will reduce smog is by cracking down on the chemicals that produce ozone, and those include nitrogen oxides, or NOx.
The problem with reducing NOx is that by reducing NOx, you also, through atmospheric chemistry, increase the concentrations of methane in the atmosphere.
Jason West is at the University of North Carolina. He says methane gas is much more potent than even carbon dioxide at heating up the atmosphere.
By reducing NOx, the net effect on climate is that you make global warming worse.
In fact, you could make warming a lot worse. If you got rid of all NOx and a related sulfur compound, that action alone would be enough to increase the Earth's temperature by 2 degrees Celsius. And that's into the danger zone for the climate, according to many scientists and governments. U.S. pollution control laws are moving us gradually in that direction.
Europe's in very much the same situation we are. They're trying to control their own ozone as well. So if they reduce their NOx and we reduce our NOx, suddenly we're talking about big numbers.
So what do you do? Leave NOx in the atmosphere? Atmospheric scientist Drew Schindel at NASA's Goddard Institute in New York City cringes at the thought.
I would have trouble with the ethics of ever saying something like people should be choking in regions where these are emitted because of the sake of global climate.
Schindel argues what's needed is a more holistic approach to the intimately linked problems of climate change and air quality.
I think we need to have policies which try to take into account both air quality and climate change. And traditionally, these have been entirely separate.
And in the case of smog, there's actually a fairly easy way to deal with this. Jason West says it's true that reducing NOx will put more methane into the air, but it's not too hard to prevent emissions of methane from other sources, like coal mines or leaky gas pipelines.
Reducing methane emissions looks like a pretty promising way in that we know that we can get some of that methane reduced even at a cost savings, and we know that it's good for climate and good for air quality.
Unfortunately, unlike smog, which is a local problem and can be addressed with local measures, methane is a global pollutant. So the usual way of attacking air pollution with local efforts simply won't do the trick.
If Los Angeles, for example, wanted to control its own methane, it would find that it would really have no effect.
So eventually, dealing with local air pollution will require global action. Lydia Wegman at the EPA says her agency is starting to move in that direction.
We definitely think that integrating air quality and climate concerns is the best way to go.
And she says that idea is being considered in the next review of smog standards, which is now getting underway. Richard Harris, NPR News.
And since these are intricately linked problems, we have a couple of linked reports here. Tomorrow, we'll hear about what it would take to control the potent warming gas, methane. Yesterday on Morning Edition, we heard how a possible solution to urban smog could end up contributing to increased global warming. Today, we'll report on methane, which also plays an important role in global warming. It appears it's on the rise in the atmosphere. NPR's Richard Harris reports on why efforts to control methane are faltering.
Methane gas comes from all sorts of sources: wetlands, rice paddies, cow tummies, coal mines, leaking natural gas pipes, garbage dumps, even termites. Drew Schindel at NASA's Goddard Institute in New York says it's built up dramatically in the atmosphere.
It's gone up by 150% since the pre-industrial period. So that's an enormous increase. CO2, by contrast, has only gone up by about 30%.
Molecule for molecule, methane is much more effective at trapping heat in the atmosphere than carbon dioxide. And that's just part of the trouble.
Methane is much more complicated once it gets into the atmosphere than something like carbon dioxide is. And that's because it reacts with a lot of different important chemicals.
For example, methane in the atmosphere also creates ground-level ozone. And ozone isn't only bad for human health, it also contributes to global warming. Schindel recently totaled up all the effects of methane emissions and realized that the heating effect is a not too distant second to carbon dioxide.
So that tells you that methane is actually a pretty big player.
Methane in the atmosphere leveled off in the 1990s, so it looked for a time that efforts to control industrial emissions were keeping this problem gas in check. But since 2007, methane levels have been on the rise again. A study published in Science magazine suggests that at least part of this increase is coming from the vast wetlands in Canada, Russia, and the Arctic. The methane in wetlands comes from naturally occurring bacteria, but study author Paul Palmer at the University of Edinburgh says the bacteria are producing more methane because the temperature is rising.
The higher the temperature, the more efficient they are at producing the methane.
So global warming is causing these wetlands to produce more methane, and the methane is causing more global warming.
This really does emphasize the fact that we are having this vicious cycle in the climate system, and we're seeing it now.
It's not yet to the stage where it's a runaway warming effect, Palmer says, but climate scientists are worried that we could hit that tipping point. There's no obvious way to control methane from natural wetlands, but at least half of methane emissions are from human activities, ranging from cattle rearing and natural gas exploration to coal mining. Since methane is the main ingredient of natural gas, efforts to capture it can actually pay for themselves. You can use the gas for energy. And Drew Schindel says, remember, methane contributes to ozone, which costs society real money because of its human health effects and because ozone also damages crops.
So if you account for all the economics, all the gains that you get through the benefits of controlling methane that are not even directly related to climate, you find that many of the reductions you could make actually pay for themselves.
So why is there relatively little effort now to control methane? Mohammed El-Ashri at the United Nations Foundation says part of the reason has been a fear by governments and advocates that attacking methane would be a dangerous distraction.
People are worried about diverting the attention away from carbon dioxide, and it shouldn't really be the case at all.
Both problems need to be solved sooner or later, but global methane projects practically ground to a halt last year. El-Ashri says that was partly because of uncertainty over the outcome of the global warming talks in Copenhagen, and partly because of the global financial crisis. There simply wasn't money to do projects, even though they were ready to go. El-Ashri is part of a group advocating for a new $200 million fund to help jumpstart these methane programs again.
Here is an opportunity to have some immediate effects in terms of impacts, particularly on the Arctic, as well as even secondary impacts like on health.
And the good thing about methane is it only stays in the air for about a decade. So if you can reduce emissions, you can see quick results. Richard Harris, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Madeline Brand. In the coming weeks, aid agencies in Haiti will begin planning how to rebuild the country. People who know Haiti worry that money could be wasted if entrenched problems aren't addressed. In a moment, I'll talk with a human rights lawyer about why the rebuilding should focus on the areas outside the capital city. First, to NPR's Christopher Joyce, who reports on some of the obstacles to long-term recovery.
When Rajiv Shah, the head of the Agency for International Development, met with reporters after the earthquake, he emphasized that the U.S. government would collaborate with, not replace, Haitian authorities.
That is the way we hope to work, in partnership and in responsiveness to requests from the Haitian government.
That could be a problem, says Gerald Murray. Murray is an anthropologist at the University of Florida who's worked in Haiti for three decades, advising international banks and organizations on aid projects. He says a lot of money has been wasted.
A bad scenario would be one in which some Haitian government officials insist that any aid be channeled through them, that they have authority to send crews to where they want them to go, and it would be a terrible outcome.
Murray is talking about long-term aid, not emergency help. He says he's interviewed thousands of Haitians, and they tell him they don't want foreign aid going to the Haitian government. They prefer that non-governmental organizations handle it.
You're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. If you use that strategy, many of the NGOs are foreign NGOs, you know, you are not developing the institutions of the country. But if you do your duty and give the money to the Haitian government, it will disappear.
Murray adds that NGOs have their own problems. They sometimes misspend the money themselves on things like overhead or travel. Murray suggests that the decline of agriculture exacerbated the quake's toll. Haitians left the countryside for Port-au-Prince, creating a dense population in poorly built housing that couldn't withstand the quake.
the village I lived in, people were still planning a future for their children on the farm. They would try to acquire more land and purchase more land. Now it is more common to find people selling land to finance emigration.
Immigration not only to Port-au-Prince, but to Haiti's neighbor, the Dominican Republic, which is not eager to see more Haitian immigrants. Murray says the quake will probably propel even more Haitians to leave the country. Anthropologist Glenn Smucker, who advises USAID and international banks on Haiti, says soil erosion is the main culprit in this social breakdown. Most of Haiti's forests have been cut for fuel, and the soil just washes away. Smucker also says farmers have switched from growing coffee to crops like corn and beans that have to be replanted every year.
Farmers on the upper slopes, for example, plant erosion-intensive crops because they have few choices. They live right on the edge of existence.
Smucker says too many Haitians now live in harm's way, on those steep, eroded slopes or in floodplains along the coast.
You have then all of the ingredients for major disaster and for death and loss of housing literally every time it rains.
And it can rain a lot there. Haiti lies smack in the middle of hurricane territory and has suffered through several deadly storms in recent years. Alex Fisher, a political scientist at Columbia University, was discussing agricultural aid with Haitian officials in Port-au-Prince when the quake hit. He was evacuated the next day. Fisher says rural Haitians depend on imported food, either bought or donated, that comes through Port-au-Prince.
Now that those lifelines are cut off, there's major questions on how to sustain a system of food and not allow for starvation.
Fisher says the Haitian government and aid groups were making plans to fight erosion by planting timber and fruit trees or building retaining walls on steep slopes. Those efforts are now on hold. Whether they'll resume depends on how post-quake aid for Haiti is spent. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
A flock of whooping cranes flew to their winter homes in Florida this week, guided by ultralight aircraft. Experts say there are only 350 of these rare birds left in the world. Their arrival is becoming an annual spectacle that draws thousands of bird lovers. Vic Michelucci joined the waiting crowd near Tampa.
As the early morning fog cleared at the Dinellen Airport in Marion County, Florida, and the temperatures slowly rose, 8-year-old Eden Poucher waited with his family to see the whooping cranes for the very first time.
What's so cool about them?
That they can fly and they just follow the ultralight. It's really cool.
Is it going to be worth it to stand out here in the cold and get up early to come see them?
Yeah, a lot. Really worth it.
Coming to watch the cranes fly over has become a yearly routine for 82-year-old Florence Scarron.
I watch these whooping cranes from the time they are hatched and when they take off from Wisconsin till they come down here for the past 4 years. And also I watch them every day on the internet.
As the drone of an engine broke the morning silence, cameras clicked. 10 slender white birds with black wingtips passed overhead, trailing behind an ultralight aircraft. When fully grown, their wings will stretch to nearly 7 feet. It's part of Operation Migration. The mission, keep the endangered birds from extinction. Liz Condi has been with the group since it began in 2001.
There were zero in eastern North America when we started migrating, that is, when we started this project. So over 100 is, we think, pretty good in 9 years.
Each year, Operation Migration pilots lead a new flock of young birds from Wisconsin to two Florida wildlife refuges, teaching them their winter migration.
There's nothing that can explain the feeling of accomplishment that you get when we finally release these birds here in Florida, knowing that we're adding to a population that 10 years ago didn't exist.
This is Richard Van Hoevelin leading the 10.
International Crane Foundation biologist Sarah Zamorski says the birds are starting on what should be a lifelong tradition.
They just have to be shown the way down south one time, whether it's with ultralights or with older birds, and then they know how to go back on their own in the spring, and so that's what they'll do. These birds that'll spend the winter at the Chazawitska release pen, usually in late March, early April, they'll just decide one day it's the right day, and they'll get up and they'll go, and they'll head back north.
And as this year's trip wraps up, the Operation Migration crew looks at it as a success. All the young birds made it south safely, starting a new generation of a species still very much at risk. For NPR News, I'm Vic Michelucci.
This is NPR News.
Let's follow up next on the International Climate Conference that was held last month in Copenhagen. Governments of some of the world's most polluting countries are scheduled to announce next Monday how much they're willing to limit their emissions of gases linked to global warming. If they are serious about meeting their commitments, they will all have to give some serious thought to the coal that they use, NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
It used to be that coal was king in the U.S. It's still royalty. Half our electricity comes from it. But now coal is guo wang. That's king in Chinese.
Coal is 80% of all power generation in China. And the Chinese use of coal is really one of the largest drivers of global coal consumption and hence global emissions.
That's Richard Morse, an energy analyst at Stanford University. Coal is the biggest single source of greenhouse gases. China and India are now huge consumers of coal, and their appetite is growing.
As long as economic development is a priority, I think climate takes a back seat. And in that situation, coal is going to win every time.
That's the conventional wisdom. But the deal made in Copenhagen may change that. By Monday, as many as 24 countries will have listed their emissions targets. China and the U.S., the two biggest coal users, are leading the group. India, another big coal power, is expected to join them. So will South Africa, a major coal exporter. So it's governments whose economies depend on coal who are now driving climate diplomacy by saying, okay, we'll cut our greenhouse gas emissions. And that means these countries will have to wrestle with the coal conundrum. We can't live without it, but we can't live with it. One energy expert who's watched this unfold is Trevor Hauser with the research firm RHG in New York. Hauser advised the U.S. climate team in Copenhagen. He says China actually might like to get off the coal train.
The coal in China is mined primarily in the northwest of the country, but the demand for that coal is in the east. And getting that coal from the mine to the power plant on the coast is a challenging and expensive undertaking.
2 years ago, an epic snowstorm shut down that supply chain. Power went out for millions of Chinese. Even China's trains stood still, stranding tens of thousands of people and a lot of coal. Hauser says it's the lack of a reliable and cheap way to transport coal that is pushing China to look for alternative fuels.
I think China has a strong incentive to move away from coal. I think there's going to be technical and economic challenges in doing it, but there's certainly a policy push to go that direction.
As for that other big consumer of coal, the U.S., the Obama administration has pledged to encourage more green energy from things like wind and solar power and to subsidize more efficient use of energy. But as energy economist Henry Jacoby of MIT points out, displacing coal is politically risky.
There are something like 22 states in the United States that have some level of coal production. Of course, that's not all the states that really care about it, because there are a number of other states whose electric power systems are heavily dependent on coal.
Jacoby points out something that politicians are loath to admit. Switching away from coal, which is cheap, so long as its negative environmental effects are not counted, will cost some consumers more on their utility bills.
If we don't have enough understanding of the climate issue for people to say, well, it's going to cost me a little bit more, but I think it's important enough. If we can't get to that point in the Congress, then we're not going to deal with the climate issue. It's a depressing thought.
But the Obama administration thinks there is an answer. Clean coal. That means extracting hydrogen from coal and using that to make electricity without emitting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. The Department of Energy is spending $404 million this fiscal year to figure out how to do that. The Chinese government is also investing in the technology. So if coal does remain a big part of the energy mix for a few decades more, it may be by virtue of a new, untested technology whose final cost can only be guessed at. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Some climate change skeptics explain their doubts by citing temperature trends. They point out that global temperatures have plateaued over the past 10 years. Well, now a new study has found at least a partial explanation why. And as NPR's Richard Harris reports, the answer is above our heads.
Global warming has not stopped. The last decade is the warmest since temperature record-keeping began, and 2009 was one of the warmest years ever recorded. But if you look over the course of the last decade, there is no strong warming trend in that time period. Susan Solomon at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Colorado says that leads to an obvious question.
People very reasonably have asked me, you know, why is it that
in the last decade, it just doesn't look like it's gotten that much warmer, even though CO2 has continued to increase, and in fact has increased quite fast.
The short answer is there's lots of natural variability in the climate. Tropical ocean patterns called El Niños and La Niñas can have strong warming or cooling effects. The sun even gets slightly brighter or dimmer. And now Solomon pinpoints another cause in a new study. It has to do with vapor way up high in the stratosphere.
There have been some surprising changes in stratospheric water vapor that have really packed a wallop as far as surface climate goes.
It turns out, starting in the year 2000, a narrow layer of the stratosphere dried out quite rapidly, and water in the atmosphere traps heat, like glass in a greenhouse, so less stratospheric water means less warming.
It's amazing that the stratosphere, which is so far removed from the surface, can exert such a big effect.
In fact, Solomon calculates that the loss of water in the stratosphere has offset about a quarter of the warming that would otherwise have occurred.
I hasten to say it is not the whole answer, probably, to the reason why there has been so little obvious warming in the last decade, but I think it's probably part of it.
Solomon figures that the stratosphere is dry because there have been fewer towering thunderstorms in the tropics to push water up there. But Andrew Dessler at Texas A&M University says this is almost certainly a temporary state of affairs.
This can't keep cooling or offsetting carbon dioxide forever.
Not forever, since first, the stratosphere can only get so dry, and second, the weather patterns that cause the stratosphere to dry out are bound to change. So this is clearly part of a shorter-term variation in the climate. Dessler compares it to the gyrations of the stock market.
You've got sort of day-to-day or month-to-month ups and downs, but there's this long-term trend, whether it's going up and down, and that's really what you care about in the stock market and in the climate.
Still, it's very useful to identify the factors that drive the short-term ups and downs. That way you aren't fooled into thinking that a temporary change is actually part of a long-term trend.
You can often be confused with what looks like a trend that may go on for a long time but turns out not to be a trend. I mean, the housing market, that's the problem in a nutshell. People saw this going up, they thought it's going on forever, but it wasn't.
The long-term trend of climate change is obvious. The most recent decade was hotter than the 1990s, the 1990s were hotter than the 1980s, and so on. And Susan Solomon says the science behind that long-term trend is well understood, and water in the stratosphere is not driving it.
But it's really helpful and fascinating, I think, to better understand the ups and downs that may happen from one year to another, from one decade to another. There's a lot more that we need to understand there.
Her new research, published online in Science Magazine, is a piece of that puzzle. Richard Harris, NPR News.